You're listening to CJSF Radio, Simon Fraser, 90.1 FM.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery, professional engineer, professional futurist, and sometimes occasional sessional instructor of future studies at Simon Fraser University. And this is a weekly show that looks at future trends and issues and important items that affect your daily life and will be affecting your life into the future. Welcome to the show. We're continuing our look at the book What's Yours Is Mine, Against the Sharing Economy by Tom Slee. Continuing from last show, the distinction between Hyndman and Anderson's long tail comes down to comparisons. The long tail compared online platforms to large chain stores and big box stores such as Walmart, or the now defunct Blockbuster Video, Tower Records, or Borders Books. But Hyndman compares the online ecosystem to a more complete range of non-digital national and local media. As a result, he catches the key aspect of the comparison that Anderson misses. Variety in a world subject to the tyranny of geography was always supplied by a variety of institutions, each capable of working at different scales. In the world of books, variety was supplied by a combination of chain stores, specialist bookstores who focused on one genre or another, especially in the big cities, independent stores and secondhand stores, whereas in the digital world, winner-take-all market structures are more common. By looking only at big chains and missing these smaller institutions, Anderson guaranteed that his comparisons would show the digital world to be more diverse and full of variety. Next section, open data. Other movements and businesses have built around digital openness and sharing, such as open access publishing for research journals, open source hardware, and open education, including massively open online courses such as MOOCs or MOOCs. Here I will look at only one other openness movement, which is that for the open government data, or open data for short. The campaign for open data has many of the same qualities as other openness initiatives. It combines nonprofit activities such as civic hacking with for-profit companies. It appeals to the civil liberties ideals of government transparency, but also advocates for free market outcomes. Claims to focus on empowering the powerless, but too often empowers the already empowered. Many would trace the origins of the open government data movement to Karl Malmud's efforts to make available public domain information, such as laws and regulations, from the various levels of government, and to put U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission, EDGAR, database online. The common arguments for making government data open are expressed by the UK Open Knowledge Foundation, namely increasing transparency, citizens need to know what their government is doing, releasing social and commercial value, driving the creation of innovative businesses and services, and encouraging participation and engagement in an echo of Lenzig's remix,
making a full read-write society. The open data movement got a big boost when it was identified by Tim O'Reilly as the basis of an initiative called Government 2.0. This, he said, is, quote, is the initiative to make government data open to the public using web-based technologies, unquote. Riley describes the move to open data as, quote, government as platform. Open data provided in a way that programmers can write software to read it, analyze it, and transform it will be the platform on which the new transparency initiatives and innovative businesses can build. Government 2.0 got a big boost in the U.S. from Barack Obama's early memo on transparency and open government and the setting up of the data.gov website. The U.K. established data.gov.uk and tied it to the David Cameron's, quote, Big Society initiative. Even Canada's notoriously secretive conservative government undertook an open data initiative, and many cities have opened up data feeds. Sounds great? Well, yes and no. The rhetoric of open data, as with other openness movements, draws heavily upon the efforts of private citizens and nonprofit groups to make governments more accountable. It has a strong civil liberties flavor and a talk of citizen engagement and of citizens' rights, giving citizens access to data that is theirs, proprietary society, collaborative democracy, transparency, and so on. In a collection of essays called Open Government, the examples almost all deal with citizens' access to the U.S. government's inner workings, campaign contributions, lobbying data, and congressional votes. Legislative proceedings, federal government contracts, and spending court proceedings. It describes efforts by non-commercial groups such as OpenSecrets.org, MapLight.org, FollowTheMoney.org, GovernmentTrack.us, and so on, to use this data to enforce greater accountability. This is all fine and good, although practitioners in these groups recognize that the access to information is just one step in the arms race, and that those who want to hide information will now look for other ways to do so. But the open data movement has a second agenda. It demands that data be made open not only to citizens, but also to private companies. The Open Knowledge Foundation defines open data as any content, information, or data that people are free to use, reuse, or redistribute without any legal, technological, or social restriction. As with open source and open content, open data affects existing power structures in very subtle ways. A well-known cautionary example comes from India. In the state of Tamil Nadu, near the town of Merakkanam, right next to a reserve forest, lies a plot of contested land. Records say this, that 3-acre plot belongs to a member of the Mudaliar caste, but lower caste Dalits living nearby claim it, and that it should be part of the reserve forest, which is not privately owned, and that the Mudaliars have pulled a fast one, using their influence in the local bureaucracy to fix the land records. The Dalits also claim that older records will bear out their claim. Contemplating the case, officials say that boundaries between land parcels in the area are often difficult to ascertain. According to development economist Bhuvan Eswari Raman, the Dalit claim was sideswept when the Tamil Nadu government undertook a program to standardize, digitize, and centralize land records. The program, pushed by the World Bank as a pro-poor, pro-transparency initiative, was undertaken to capitalize on the boom of nearby Chennai. The absence of clear land titles has made extensive land purchases time-consuming and expensive. And this was a bottleneck to large-scale development projects. As part of the program, the Tamil Nadu government declared that the digitized records would be the only evidence admissible in court for land claims. So the older records and less precise data that formed the basis of the Dalit claims suddenly lost any footing that they originally had, and therefore their claim was sunk. A new generation of land developers grew up alongside the digitized records, firms who had the resources, skills, and information to make efficient use of this new resource. These developers lobbied effectively for records and spatial data to be made open, and then used their advantages to displace smaller developments who, as Raman writes, quote, relied on their knowledge of local histories and relationships to assemble land for development. The FX went far beyond the three-acre plot near Marak Kananam. Newly visible master plans became used as, quote, the reference point for legal and illegal spaces, and as a justification for evicting the poor from their economic and residential spaces. The pro-poor initiative turned out to be anything but, and Tamil Nadu was not alone in running an open data project that made life harder for the poor. Neighboring Karnataka Bhumi, or Land E-Governance Program, has had similar effects. Raman and her colleagues concluded that, quote, the digitization of land records has led to increased corruption, much more bribes, and substantially increased time taken for land transactions. At another level, it facilitated very large players in the land markets to capture vast quantities of land at a time when Bangalore experiences a boom in the land market, unquote. The story is another case of the missing middle, where small businesses with local expertise are brutally displaced, thanks to digital technologies, by fewer and bigger companies with the resources and expertise to make the most of formalized data sets. When commerce is mentioned by open data proponents, they tend to use language of entrepreneurship and innovation and contrast the new firms with the aging business models they seek to replace. And they often present commercial use as a complement to civic use. Michael Grudstein, a leading light in the field of community information, who has been constructively raising concerns about how open data may, quote, empower the empowered, for some time, argues that skills and resources needed to make effective use are complements to data. He quotes from a study who uses the British My Society, They Work For You.com open government initiative. Quote, people above the age of 54 tend to be overrepresented, while the younger than 45 are underrepresented in comparison to the internet population. In terms of demographics, there's a strong male bias and a strong overrepresentation of people with university degrees that also translate into a strong participation from high-income groups. 1 in 5 users, 21%, of the site had not been politically active within the last year. After attending a conference on open government data, Grudstein comments on a blog post that, quote, the attempt to enhance democratic participation has ended up providing an additional opportunity for those who already, because of their income, education, and overall conventional characteristics of higher status, including age, gender, etc., now have the means to communicate with and influence politicians. The additional information and additional communications channel has thus had the effect of reinforcing patterns of opportunity that are already there rather than widening the base of participation and influence. Kentaro Toyama, an expert in the use of information technology for development, argues that, quote, in the context where literacy and social capital are unevenly distributed, technology tends to amplify inequalities rather than reduce them. An email account cannot make you more connected unless you have some existing social network to build on. Development studies scholar Kevin Donovan sees similarities between open data efforts and James Scott's book, Seeing It Like a State. Open standards and structured machine-readable data are key parts of the open data program. And for Donovan, these formalization and standardizations is far more value-laden than typically considered. Open data programs, like the state, seek to make society legible through simplification. Standardized data, like the state, operates over a multitude of communities and attempts to eliminate cultural norms through standardization. He writes, eliminating illegibility in this way reduces the public's political autonomy because it enables powerful entities to act on a greater scale, Scott argued. A thoroughly legible society eliminates local monopolies of information and creates a kind of national transparency through the uniformity of codes, identities, statistics, regulations, and measures. At the same time, it is likely to create new positional advantages for those at the apex who have the knowledge and access to easily decipher the new state-created formats. Open data undermines the power of those who benefit from the idiosyncrasies and complexities of communities. Local residents who understand the complexity of their community due to prolonged exposures. The Bluhumi Land Records Program is an example of this particular situation. It explicitly devalues informal information of particular places and history, making it legally irrelevant. In the brave new world of open data, such knowledge is trumped by the ability to make effective queries of the quote-unquote open land records. The valuing of technological facility over idiosyncratic and informal knowledge is baked right into the open data efforts. More encouragingly, Donovan looks at how some data geeks recognize their own myopia in the Map Kybernia project, which started as a community mapping project to trace the massive Nairobi slum. Some questioned the need for the project, as locals already knew their surroundings intimately. Making mapping information available would make it more likely that it would benefit external parties rather than the residents themselves.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you're listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenary. We're now going to take a short break and listen to a very important public service announcement.
Every year, countless people succumb to the temptation to purchase exotic animals like hedgehogs, lizards, monkeys, even tigers and bears to keep as pets. But life in captivity is often a death sentence for these animals, who may suffer from malnutrition, an improper environment, and the stress of confinement. For more information on this issue, visit the BCSPCA website at www.spca.bc.ca.
Welcome back. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenari, professional futurist.
Welcome back. We are looking at the book, What's Yours is Mine, Against the Sharing Economy by Tom Slee. The problems the project seeks to address are what Donovan calls wicked problems, ill-defined, tangled, and resistant to technological fixes. However, although it began as an example of misdiagnosing a wicked problem, for example, Kiberia's poverty and marginalization, as a tame one, insufficient information availability, Map Kiberia has admirably grown beyond a reductionist approach. It has expanded to include other forms of activity, such as citizen reporting, and has taken steps to ensure local ownership of the project. The project has moved beyond a technological goal to a set of sociological goals. Its list of sponsors, interestingly, includes only non-commercial organizations. Donovan contrasts Map Kiberia's evolution with that of the more narrowly technological mapping projects such as Google Maps, Maker Initiatives, which have been accused of unethical exploitation of open communities. The danger of such projects is that by eliminating the illegality that privileges local knowledge and outsider knowledge, they may allow the already powerful to gain access to community knowledge that was previously hidden from them, to see like a slum. When it comes to development programs, Donovan concludes open data is not enough and should not be the primary focus. Instead, transparencies must be linked with deliberate development, effectuating social change that cannot avoid the need to actually address the underlying dynamics of power. One of the most valuable complements to open data is, ironically, other data. A bus schedule is more valuable if you can combine it with a map. This combinatorial aspect of open data raises problems for government-collected data. As legal scholars Tessa Scassa and Lisa M. Campbell highlighted, because data protection legislation, quote, typically requires that information collected for specific purposes should not be used for other purposes without the consent of those about whom the data was collected. Scassa and Campbell look at how even relatively low-quality spatial data may attract the application of data protection or privacy laws, particularly when it's matched or combined with other data sets. They look, for example, at Ottawa's police crime mapping tool, which is a map of calls for police assistance provided through the collaboration between the Ottawa police and public figures, Public Engines, which is a U.S. company. If insurance companies make decisions about rates or insurability based on the crime mapping data, or if security companies use it to target specific areas for marketing campaigns, then this site could be violating these conditions. The faith in markets sometimes goes farther among open data advocates. It's not just that open data can create new markets. There is a substantial portion of the push for open data that explicitly seeks to create new markets as an alternative to providing government services. Political scientist Joe Bates has highlighted the way in which open government data programs can be used as a form of privatization and deregulation. A deliberate attempt to create new markets in the public sector information, or PSI, reuse instead of providing government services. Here's a summary of the quotation. Quote, the current transparency agenda of the UK government, supported by prominent open data advocates, should be recognized as an initiative that also aims to enable the marketization of public services. And this is something that is not readily apparent to the general observer. Further, while democratic ends are claimed in the desire to enable the public to hold the state to account via these measures, there is an issue in utilizing a dichotomy between the state and a notion of the public, which does not differentiate between citizens and commercial interests. So the construction encourages those attracted to civic engagement into an embrace of solidarity with profit-seeking interests, distanced from the ever-suspect notion of the state. Here is the kind of activity that now comes under the Open Data Initiative, again from Bates, quote, "There is a significant lobbying by the financial industry to get better access to UK weather data so that it is able to compete with this weather risk management market. Groups such as the Light Hill Risk Network, of which Lloyd's of London is a member, have lobbied governments for better weather data so that they can develop risk-based weather products. Similarly, the insurance industry has requested real-time information on the pretext that they might respond more quickly to extreme weather events such as flooding. My own research and the recent announcements suggest that these demands have been met enthusiastically by well-placed policymakers and national governments who are keen to develop a UK weather derivatives market. Weather risk management might seem like an odd industry, but Bates reports that, quote, "this weather risk management market far outweighs the USA's commercial weather products market, which in the year 2000 was estimated to be at approximately $500 million per year, touching over $45 billion in 2025 and 2026. We're going to continue looking at this very interesting description of the sharing economy and how it impacts all of us. So we'll be covering that in future shows. So please stay tuned.
You have been listening to Future Talk on CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 cable FM in Burnaby. And Future Talk is a weekly show on important issues that affect you and your future. And this is Dr. Teneri, professional futurist, reminding you that if you're not willing to make the effort to invent your own future, then others will be only too happy to invent it for you. See you next week.
Listening to CJSF Radio Simon Fraser 90.1 FM.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, SFU's community radio station broadcasting live from Burnaby, BC.
This is Nicole Hines with CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, and I'm here with Am Johal, Executive Artistic Director of the Indian Summer Festival that's taking place at venues across Vancouver, Burnaby, and Surrey from July 9th to 19th, 2026. So Am, thank you so much for joining me. How are you?
Great. Wonderful to be here with you, Nicole. Great to be able to join you folks, and hello to all the listeners out there.
Yes, wonderful. So let's get into the Indian Summer Festival. I would love to for you to maybe share a bit about the history and tell us a little bit about the festival.
Absolutely. We like to think of ourselves as the Festival for Curious Minds. We're
Hey.
into our 16th year. I first came.